I think we're almost ready to get started. So if you want to find a seat, I think there's a few more down in front. But what a phenomenal day, right? Have you had a great day? How many have had a great day? Yeah. I always love when speakers say y'all a lot, right? We know we're in Texas when we get to listen to Reese. So I'm Renee Schroeder. I'm a Senior Vice President for Charles Schwab Core Technology Solutions here in Austin. And I'm proud to say this is our first year sponsoring the Texas Women's Conference. So I don't know if I see any Schwabies in the room there. There's a couple back there. Hi. So just really, really pleased to be here. This is the first year that we've been able to do this. We've been growing in Austin, as you're probably all aware, and have a big campus up in Gracie Farms. So come by and visit us. But so I think you're all here to figure out what you do when you feel stressed out, overworked, tired, all the time. And so I've never met a resiliency expert till I just met Ann. So I'm really, really excited for her to share with us just some tips and techniques about what we can do to get through that and to adapt. I think we heard a little bit of it from Reese. How do we learn and how do we succeed? So this is going to be an exciting session. We've got Ann, who is actually going to be signing her book right after this. So let her run out first so she can get there, because it's crazy getting around this place, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So Ann is a best-selling author. She's got a couple books out right now. A speaker. She's a survivor. I'm sure she'll tell us a little bit about that. Trainer. And she's an optimist. So I just love that, because we've heard a lot about that today as well. She's known for her raw honesty. Sometimes that's good. We'll see. We'll see if that's good today. She's also got some edgy humor, we understand, and her personal story. So you don't want to listen to me. So let me go ahead and bring Ann Grady up to the stage. So.
Hey, everybody. After lunch, how are you feeling? Awesome. So I want to start out by asking you a question, and it's one that I want you to take seriously. So give it some thought. By a show of hands, how many of you have survived the worst thing that has ever happened to you? Oh, my gosh. That's 100% success rate. That is amazing. So you have got a good start on this resilience thing, and it's a good thing, too, because the average person experiences 5 to 6 traumas in a lifetime. So if you are not having one, be kinder than necessary, because somebody else is. So a recent study of 1,000 women found that 75% of these women felt guilty when it came to balancing life and work. Anybody can relate? Okay, 72% said they feel anxious and exhausted at the end of the day. Anyone? 42% said they feel inferior after visiting Pinterest. Who can make cupcakes like that? Nobody, nobody, right? And 52% said that they didn't know how they were going to get through the next day. Now, we have become like hamsters on a wheel, right? We go through our week, and what do we look forward to? Thank God it's Friday. And then it's Friday, and we have the weekend. But then Sunday, we need a weekend to recover from all the things we had to do during our weekend. And God forbid we take a vacation and our inbox explodes so much that we decide we don't want to do that again. And the thing is, if we are not conscious and deliberate about building resilience, we end up where we're headed. You know, I used to think that resilience was in your genetics, like skinny thighs. You either have it or you don't. But what I have learned is that it's a skill set, and whether we like it or not, life is going to give us plenty of chances to practice. So here's what I want you to do. Get a partner and decide who is partner A and who is partner B. Go. All right. Now, I can tell a lot about your personality, because type A personalities are the ones who are like, UBA. And type B personalities are going, whatever, I really don't care. All right, partner A, I want you to make a fist as tight as you can. Partner A, make a fist. Partner B, duck. No, I'm joking. Partner A, make a fist. Partner B, you have 3 seconds. Get it open. Go. All right. Come on back. So, shh. Partner A, we clearly have a lot of competitive women. Partner A, when partner B tried to open your fist, what did you do? You squeezed it tighter. And when you squeezed tighter, what did your partner do? Tried harder. I know we have a few psychology majors in here. Like, please open your hand. Your partner was going, how did that make you feel? But for the most part, I want to know why you resisted. I never told partner A not to let partner B open your hand. Oh, it's because we react. We react to people, situations, challenges. How many of you have gotten a phone call, looked at your caller ID in the last couple of days and just went, oh, crap. Don't point if they're next to you. Okay? The problem is that anytime we are reacting, we are subconsciously relinquishing control. If you've ever woken up and checked your email before you got out of bed and it set the tone for the day, right? You spill a cup of coffee. Little things like that. And we let that take over our day. And I'm here to ask you to be mindful each moment by making subtle choices in the way you think and the way you behave to get the result you want. Now, I thought I had a master's degree and all this experience and that made me so smart, but it turns out that I learned nothing until I had my child. So how many of you have kids? I was the best parent before I had children. Now I give them bad advice. Strangers have the best candy. Go. If you see a van, hop in if they offer a puppy. So this is my son, Evan. Evan is 15 years old, and Evan is severely mentally ill. Evan first tried to kill me when he was 3 years old with a pair of scissors. When he was 11 months old, I started him in therapy. At 18 months old, I became a single mom because he cried 20 hours a day. At 4, he began his first antipsychotic. At the age of 7, he was hospitalized in his first pediatric psych unit in Dallas, where I lived at the Ronald McDonald House. At the age of 10, he was hospitalized once again. This time, I had to fly to Iowa to give a keynote a couple of days later, and it was like December. And so I'm at the Austin-Bergstrom Airport. I live in Round Rock, which is just north of Austin. And so I'm at the airport, and I have a horrible migraine, and our flight was delayed by 3 hours. So I found one of those crazy expensive chair massage places, like $1,000 a minute you would normally ever get, right? And so I was just so in so much pain, I didn't care, and she put my face in the cradle, and I started to sob. And it wasn't like adorable little sniffles. It was like snot bubbles, and it was not pretty. And she said, oh my gosh, tell me what's going on. And I did. Turns out she has a special needs child who also lived in Round Rock. And she said, honey, when you get home, I want to come to your house and give you a 90-minute massage, my treat. So note to self, if you are in the Austin Bergstrom Airport, cry uncontrollably and ask for Becky. So Becky came to the house, did the massage, and when she was done, she said, hey, just a heads up, you've got a swollen lymph node behind your right ear. It's pretty typical. You've been crying a lot. You should just get it checked out. And so I did, and just to be safe, they did a CAT scan and gave me antibiotics and all of that good stuff. And so the day we're checking Evan out of the hospital, 2 months to the day we checked him in, because that's all insurance would cover. 2 months to the day that we checked him in, I got a call from a doctor who said, I've got some bad news. It's not a lymph node, it's a tumor, and it's in your salivary gland, and it's traveling towards your brain. And we need to get it out now. So February 26th of 2014, I go in for what they said would be a routine surgery. Tumor was supposed to be the size of a dime. Turned out to be the size of a small avocado. And after a six-hour surgery, after being joined by two neurosurgeons, they came out and told my mom and my now husband, my face was completely paralyzed. They didn't think it would recover. The nerve was very badly damaged. And so my whole career just kind of flashed before me. I mean, I train and speak, and I had a speech impediment, and I drooled, and I couldn't close my eyes. So 2 days after the surgery, a speck of dust scratched my cornea. So the doctor said, well, Ann, we've got to put a gold weight into your upper eyelid, and we have to stitch up your bottom eyelid, and we have to do that before you start 6 weeks of radiation. So my mom says, Ann, I'll watch the kids. I have a beautiful 16-year-old daughter, Riley, as well. My mom said, Ann, I'll watch the kids. You guys go away for the weekend. You deserve it. You've been through a lot. And we thought, well, since we've been so lucky lately, let's go to Vegas. So we did, and it was wonderful. I was taking a picture with a minion. I was having a blast. I had my eye patch with a smiley face on. It was great. We're walking down the stairs towards Caesar's Palace, our first morning there, and I look at my husband and I say, honey, this is the best I have felt since the surgery. Like, I'm finally starting to feel better. And then I fell down the stairs and broke my foot in four places. You can't make this shit up. So there I am. I come home and I'm like, hey, you know, and it was kind of one thing after another. And what I learned is that there are things that you can do proactively so that when you not get knocked down, you will get back up, not only faster, but stronger and wiser and braver. And those are the things I want to share. And the first thing is that change only happens one of two ways. We're either inspired or we're desperate. What do you think we wait for? Desperate, right? Anybody watch Law and Order in here? I like SVU because I want my crimes especially heinous. And in the wise words of Captain Cragen, change doesn't happen until it has to, right? Most of us keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. The question I would encourage you to ask yourself is the way I'm thinking and behaving getting me closer to what I want? Because it boils down to this, you only have two choices, right? You can think and behave the way you are and get the result you're getting, or you can change the way you think and behave to get a different result. It doesn't work any other way. And we can blame external forces, and we can blame sexism, and we can blame everybody else and everything around us, but the truth is we are the only ones we can control. And we can't fix other people. I've tried. Anybody in a relationship? Okay, you've tried too. So it doesn't work. It's like teaching a pig to fly. So let's talk about a fish. So in 1942, scientists at the Wolf Lake Hatchery in Michigan conducted a study. So they take this pike, it's a carnivorous fish, and they put it into a tank full of minnows. And so what do you think happens when you put a carnivorous fish into a tank full of minnows? Okay, it eats them. So then they decided, okay, this time we'll put in more minnows, but we're going to encase them in a glass cylinder so the pike can see the minnows, but it can't get to them. And it tried. I mean, it rammed its head up against the glass over and over and over again until finally it just settled on the bottom of the tank. So the scientists then released the minnows from the cylinder so they could swim freely all around. What do you think the pike did? Nothing. Learned helplessness, right? And it's become known as the pike syndrome. Now, it might not be a glass cylinder, but our fear and our self-limiting beliefs create imaginary barriers we are convinced we cannot break through. We let fear hold us back. What would you try if you weren't afraid? I loved how Brené talked about failure. I have a keynote called Fail Faster. It's so important that we let ourselves feel that level of discomfort. You know, your resume and your eulogy should not be the same thing. Nobody is going to be standing by your graveside going, damn, she worked 80 hours a week. Yeah. No, right? Part of it is figuring out, how do I cultivate courage? How do I cultivate grit? How do I build resilience? And so we can learn a lot from a lobster. So how many of you like lobster? All right, for me, it's just a butter delivery mechanism. It's like butter transference. Did you know that when a lobster grows, its shell becomes constricting and tight? It can't grow with it. So in order to grow, the lobster actually has to shed its shell. It hides under a few rocks. It waits vulnerably and uncomfortably while its new shell grows. And it does this its entire life, right? So the big lobsters are the brave lobsters. But it also teaches us that discomfort is a catalyst for growth. We achieve strength through struggle. Think about the worst things you've been through in your life. You learned from them. And a lot of this is how we perceive the adversity and how we explain it to ourselves. You cannot have growth without struggle. And a lot of people come up to me afterwards and say, Ann, my situation's nothing compared to yours, but my kid, my neighbor, my niece, my nephew. First of all, stop that. It's called comparative suffering, and it's an exercise in futility. We all struggle at 100%. Whatever you're going through is real to you. It doesn't matter how it compares to your next door neighbor or the people that you work with, right? It's all real to us. But it's about cultivating courage, and this is the definition of courage that got me through. And it is one that I still to this day remind myself of, and it's basically, it doesn't have to be these huge acts of valor and bravery. It's not running a Tough Mudder, right? It's getting up every day and continuing to go on. Does it mean you won't have shitty days? Of course not. But you can't appreciate the good ones unless you do. And to quote Brené, who's one of my heroes, you can have courage or you can have comfort, but you cannot have both. Men don't worry about whether or not they're skilled to do the job. They think, we'll figure it out. Women feel like we have to have 100% of the qualifications in order to do the job, right? It's about grit and taking chances. And part of that starts with the way we behave. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to tell me what these things have in common. Your morning coffee, brushing your teeth, my ex-husband. There are habits, right? We're creatures of habit. All right, so here's what I want you to do. I want you to cross your arms. All right, now I want you to cross them in the opposite direction. All right, which way was more awkward, the first or the second? The second, and that's because it's happening from different parts of your brain. So our brain is incredible. It has gone through three levels of evolution. The first level of evolution is our snake brain, our reptilian brain. It's responsible for heart rate, breathing, respiration, balance, things that you don't even think about. And if you imagine your brain as a fist with your thumb tucked inside of it, it's basically at the base of your skull. The next evolution that our brain went through is called the limbic system, and it's right in the middle of your brain. It's responsible for memories, habits, emotions. It's also your fight or flight place where your amygdala live, and that is where our habits go. So when you crossed your arms the first time, it came from a place of habit. You've done it the same way so many times you didn't even have to think about it. Think about if you had to work really hard this morning at how to get dressed and how to hold a fork or a cup or a toothbrush, or how to walk, or whatever, right? Our brain creates cognitive shortcuts. It creates habits as a way to help it save energy. Our next evolution is our neocortex, specifically right behind our forehead, the prefrontal cortex, okay? And this is where higher level thinking happens. Problem solving, creativity, emotional regulation, attention management, you know, all kinds of stuff that you do all day long at work that requires thought. Well, what happens when you sense a threat and your brain does not know the difference between a saber-toothed tiger charging at you or a snarky email from your boss? It does not know the difference between a real or perceived threat. And so when that happens, have you ever read an email and stopped breathing? Arianna Huffington named that email apnea, okay? So your brain experiences a threat, and what happens is your amygdala shoot cortisol and adrenaline and norepinephrine basically to help you fight, freeze, or run away, okay? The challenge is, as our brain has not evolved, it doesn't know which threats are real, so it takes every threat it perceives, and as we listened to Sean talk earlier today, once you start looking for those, you find more of them because you find what you look for, right? Think about it. How many of you have ever dated someone where at the beginning of the relationship you thought they could be the one? Right? Everything they did was adorable. The way they walked was cute. The way they talked was cute. Everything was cute. Somewhere along the way, you figured out they were not the one. And everything they did drove you crazy, like watching them chew makes you nauseous. Has anybody dated that person? Is anybody still married to that person? There's always one. So our brain creates these cognitive shortcuts so that if we do something, think something, behave a certain way repeatedly, it converts it into a habit, but it doesn't know the difference between the habits that support our success and the habits that sabotage it. It doesn't know the difference between coming home from work and eating a pint of Häagen-Dazs or going to the gym. It just takes whatever we repeatedly do. And most of us say, well, I need to wait till I feel motivated. Well, that's not the way our brain works. We have to behave our way into thought process much of the time. So let's talk about how we do that. First of it is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. How many of you talk to yourself? The rest of you are like, do I talk to myself? How many of you answer yourself? Yeah, okay. The thing is, the way we view ourselves is everything. It shapes the way we see the world. And so I don't know if you're familiar with Carol Dweck or her research around mindset, but she talks about the fact that we have either a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. We either think our abilities are innate, our talents are fixed, we got where we are because we're smart, Or we have a growth mindset, knowing we can learn, we can develop, we can grow. Just because we didn't get where we wanted to go today doesn't mean we won't get there tomorrow, right? And that takes courage. It takes courage and vulnerability to have a beginner's mindset, to be open to what you might learn, to think about it from a place of how do I gain something rather than validate what I already know, right? So let's talk a little bit about technology. Raise your hand if you've got a phone. All right, everybody. So did you know that on average you touch your smartphone every 6 minutes? It's 150 times a day. We give a 5-inch piece of hardware with no pulse more time and attention than the people in our lives. Now the phone is just an app on a larger device we hope no one uses because texting is easier. When I was a little girl, if you wanted to answer the phone, you didn't know who was there. It was a crapshoot. It was attached to a wall. Do you remember those little spirals? And you could only go as far as it would take you before it snapped you back into the wall. And if you didn't answer it, you just weren't available. And now we're available 24/7, and our mind was not meant to do that. Put yourself in airplane mode, right? We talk about disconnection with our kids and the way we should do things. But most of us, as a habit, check our phone when we're bored because being alone with our thoughts is that scary, right? Think about your relationship to technology. It's not that it's bad. It does so many great things. But if that's where your time and attention are spent, then you sacrifice all of the amazing things that are out there. My daughter's 16, and she can't imagine a life without a smartphone. Like, the thought of that is impossible. What do you do? Well, you talk to people. No. Right? I don't want to do that. Okay? The average person, the average American, spends a year of their life trying to figure out what to watch on TV. That statistic came out before Netflix, Prime, and all of the streaming services. So I don't know about you, but it could take an hour to figure out that we're still going to watch Dexter. Right? So part of this is knowing how to care for you. Now, I've got a girlfriend who loves hot yoga, and I was telling her I really wanted to get more exercise, and she said, well, you need to try hot yoga. It's amazing. And I'm like, I don't even like room temperature yoga. I'm fairly confident I'm not going to like hot yoga. She said, no, it's so refreshing. When you're done, you drink a kale smoothie. It's amazing. And I'm like, kale, it's like wet sadness. I don't understand. I said, I hate kale. It's bitter. She said, no, you've clearly never tried kale chips. I'm like, you've clearly never tried chips. So what works for one person does not necessarily mean it will work for the other. Just because your friend jogs around Town Lake or whatever it is they do does not mean that's going to work for you. It's about finding the right fit. And that takes courage because it's not always the first time, right? You wouldn't go on one date and it not work out and you go, I'm done dating. But we exercise for 2 weeks and go, screw it. We'll eat cake. Okay? So my mom, I'll tell you about her in a second, but one of the things she always said is if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. Like, you have to figure out what success looks like for you. Again, your eulogy and your resume, not the same. How do you define success for your life? It's not a title. Right? Some people think it's money. When I have enough money in the bank, then I'll know I'm successful. But I can tell you anything you can get, you can unget. Right? For some people, it's this beautiful home. It's when I get the great car, when my remodel is done, when I have a second place, whatever it is. For some people, it's when I love my job so much that I hug my computer. Anybody do that? Good. I'm worried about you if you do. For some people, it's a happy, healthy family. And to be truthful, that was my definition of success, when my family is happy and healthy. But what do you do when your family's not happy or healthy? Does that, by definition, make you unsuccessful? So for me, it's him. The dog. No, my husband's back there. He's okay with him. He knows. It's all mental. It's a mental thing, right? But how do you define success for you? How do you know when you achieve it? Most of us just blow past it and keep going and raising the bar, and then we continue to feel disappointed in ourselves rather than celebrating that. And I'm guilty of it too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not up here to sound hypocritical. I struggle with this stuff every single day, right? There'll be times where I'll be complaining and my husband will like, what would you teach? And I'm like, don't use my own shit on me. It's not funny. right? Because nobody gets it right all the time. This is a practice. Resilience is a practice. That's all it is. So my mom is a flight attendant, and I'm not supposed to tell you which airline, so we'll just call it Southwest. She started when she was 51, and she's 69. She'll be 70 in June, and she's still a flight attendant. So she gives these really great announcements, and my favorite one is for the oxygen mask, where she'll say, in case of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, please place your mask on and then assist your child. And if you're traveling with more than one child, please pick your favorite or the one with the most potential. Yeah. But there is a reason they tell you to put your mask on first, right? How much time do you think about what other people think about you? How much do you spend on Facebook going, why can't my family look like that? I can't go on there the first week of school because other kids have their lunchboxes and they look happy with their parents and mine's punching a hole into sheetrock. You'll see me post today. You'll see me do all kinds of amazing social media. I'm here. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so excited. But you know what you won't see? At 4 a.m. this morning, when a sound woke me out of a dead sleep faster than any sound can do, how many of you have pets? So you know there is no sound that will wake you out of a dead sleep quite like this one. But by the time I got up, it had been eaten. We don't post that stuff. You don't post the fight you have standing at the dishwasher around how to properly load silverware for the 18th time it goes up. Okay? Think about what are you doing to care for you? And I know it can sound like, I don't have time to do that. You don't have time not to. The doctor said, I thought I got my tumor in my face because I held my phone. And he said, no, it's because you were under a decade of intense stress and had nowhere for it to go, right? I want you to think about something. We do high-intensity interval training because we know it burns calories and we know it torches fat. Do high-intensity life, right? In your work day, work really hard, set a timer for 20 minutes and bust your ass and work really, really hard. And then give yourself permission to take a couple of deep breaths and a walk around the building. Do not eat your lunch at your desk. Women who work 41 or more hours a week are significantly more likely to have heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and every other stress-related illness. Duke did a study, and they found that they divided two groups, or one group of depressed patients. So they took a patient, group of patients with depression, and they divided them into two groups. And one group they gave an antidepressant, and one group they had exercise three times a week, moderate intensity. And after 6 weeks, they brought them back together, and they found that the group who took the antidepressant reduced depressive symptoms by 47%. The group that exercised reduced depressive symptoms by 45%. Now, no judgment here. I'm on everything but roller skates. But antidepressants have gone up 400% since 1987, right? We're the wealthiest nation in the world. We're most, like, depressed, suicidal, self-medicated society in the world. And part of it's because we're not caring for us. 50 to 70 million Americans have a sleep or wakefulness disorder, so much so that the CDC called it the number one public health epidemic. You lose more IQ points going 24 hours without sleep than you do smoking pot. Now, I'm not suggesting you go spark up, right? But it's about making you a priority. What are you doing for you? And if you have kids, it's teaching them that boundary, right? Some of us have kids where we go to the bathroom and they stand outside the door and hit the door, right? We train people how to treat us. Give yourself time and space to focus on you. Now, for me, I'm not a huge exercise fan. I don't have that, like, oh, I go run 10 miles and then feel fabulous. I don't like those people. But I do swim because I realized how important it was to my overall mood and how much it impacted my productivity and my relationship. So I swim in a pool, and there is a line painted on the bottom of the lane, so I go in a straight line. How many of you have ever swam in an ocean? What happens if you try to swim in a straight line? You get carried off by the tide, by the current. So they'll tell you, if you're an open water swimmer, aim for an immovable object. a buoy, or a lighthouse. What is your lighthouse? What is so important to you that you are willing to withstand the waves and the storms and the weather and everything else that goes along with it because you're so focused on achieving that? And there can be multiple in your life for different areas of your life, but most of us get stuck reacting and we're giving away our control rather than living on purpose, leading on purpose. They have found that resilient managers who focus on resilience with their team's productivity skyrockets. They have higher levels of engagement, less turnover, less sick days, and they're more effective, and they have a higher sense of well-being. What is your lighthouse? It's your purpose. It's your passion. And don't lose sight of that. So here's what I do. Every month, I sit down and have a glass or four of wine. I'm joking. It's vodka. I go through this activity, and I really try. I'm going to tell you how to get this in just 1 second. So you're welcome to take a picture of it, but I'm going to tell you how to get it. I sit down and set a goal or two, not in every area, because it's unmanageable and unrealistic, and then we can't do it. Focus on one thing. People who write down their goals are way more likely to accomplish them. One study said 88%. One study says 30%. But we know that there is a percent, 72% of statistics are made up. Only 23% of people know that. Okay. Make deliberate goals for yourself in your life. What is it you want to accomplish in your career, with your finances, in your marriage, with your partner, with your children? How many times do we go to a restaurant and we see entire families sitting on their device? And I've been guilty of it, right? We all do it. We all do the stuff we say we know we shouldn't do. We all know we should eat better, exercise more, and sleep more. But we don't do it because knowing doesn't translate into doing. These are habits. And we have to create these habits on purpose. And we can only create one habit at a time. And whoever told you it's 60 days, 90 days, 120 days, they're full of garbage. It takes however long it takes your brain to recreate a neural pathway. Because however long you have been thinking or behaving a certain way, it is etched a neural pathway in your brain. And in order to break a habit, you must have one to replace it with. So if you would like a self-assessment, a resilient self-assessment, and a copy of this. I'm going to tell you how to get that at the end, but basically you're going to text 555-888 and the letters TCFW, and I'll show you at the end again, but I'm happy to send it to you. I'll sign you up for my Tuesday Truth Bomb newsletter, and it's just once a month, and if you don't like it, you can unsubscribe. But the thing is, a lot of it stems from how we see ourselves. This is what I thought I was when I was little. I wanted to be Linda Carter. You know, I had the underoos, I had the tinfoil wrist cuffs, like strongest tinfoil available, Reynolds all the way. I had a headband, I had a truth lasso. My dog Noodles and I, we'd like patrol my Connecticut neighborhood and we'd like seek to battle injustice. And when we saw like rabbits looking weird, I would duck behind a tree and I would twirl around until I became Wonder Woman. And I was brave and I was fierce and I thought I could do anything. But at somewhere along the line, that turns into a very different message. What's wrong with me? I can't believe I ate that. I can't believe I wore that. I can't believe I said that. Right? The way you see yourself shapes the way you see the world. It's impossible to behave in a way inconsistent with the way you see yourself. Now, how do you find out how you're viewed? Well, my grandmother always used to say, ask for feedback. If enough people tell you you're tired, go take a nap, right? She also used to say, if you act like an ass, don't be surprised if people try to ride you, but that was a whole nother talk. How do you talk to yourself about yourself? When was the last time you looked in the mirror and said something really nice to yourself? Did you know that your brain, when you talk in first person, if you say, I can do this, your brain doesn't recognize it. It keeps it as an emotional thought. If you talk to yourself in third person and you got this, it brings you back to your prefrontal cortex. Simply the act of talking to yourself about yourself brings that into the prefrontal cortex. How are you talking to yourself? What are the messages you're sending yourself? Because you can say, I want to build resilience, but if you're walking around every day going, I'm such an idiot, stupid, 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 you're defeating yourself before you ever get started, because then when you hit a rough patch, when you hit adversity, you're already so low and you already have beaten yourself up so much. Trust me, as a mom of a special needs kid, I spent a lot of time beating myself up. It's real easy to do, and you feel very alone, especially with mental illness, because you can't see it. And people ask, why do you talk about it? Well, statistically, 1 in 5 adults are mentally ill, so look around you. Come on, judgmentally, whatever, right? If 1 in 5 adults are mentally ill and you don't see that person, it's you, right? You've got to give yourself some tools in your arsenal. So one of the things, and Sean Aker talked about this, is the way you view the world. Now, he talked about a set point, and I'm glad he did, because everybody has a set point, an optimism set point. You are born with it, right? You can thank your parents for 50% of who you are. They are your genetics. 10% is your environment, but 40% is the way you choose to view the world. And this is not easy, and I don't always get it right. It's a habit. It is a habit. But there are some things that we know about this. Again, it does not mean that you don't pay attention to the negative. You're not a Pollyanna. You don't wear rose-colored glasses. But the way you interpret it shapes the way you see it and experience it. If you change the story, you change the outcome. So Martin Seligman, father of positive psychology, said that it's important to pay attention to your explanatory style. And your explanatory style is the way you talk about the adversity in your life. Now, most of us, I heard myself on the phone going, I know it's not fair. Oh, it sucks. It's so hard. Why me? Everybody else has healthy kids. They can go to Walmart. I can't go to Walmart. My kid will take down an end cap. Why, right? The thing is, you believe what you tell yourself, and you start looking for all the reasons it's not fair. So your explanatory style, follow the 3 P's. When you talk about adversity, do you talk about it being personal? It's all about me. Why does it happen to me? Or bad stuff just happens to good people, right? Next, permanence. Now this happened, everything is going to be horrible forever. It's going to be awful forever. I didn't get the promotion. I'm never going to get it. And finally, pervasiveness. Is it just this one area that kind of sucks, or is everything in your whole life falling to hell in a handbasket? Because there are usually things that you can grasp onto that are positive. If you're not grateful most of the time, you're not paying attention. There is so much to be grateful for. So a British researcher named Gottman did a study. He took 700 newly married couples and he observed them for 15 minutes. And he and his team were able to determine with 94% accuracy which couples would be married a decade later. Pretty incredible, right? The only difference was that they made 5 comments that were positive to every 1 negative comment. 5 positive to 1 negative. They found that people who are incredibly resilient cultivate positive emotions on purpose. I listen to the serious comedy channels all the time because it turns out that when you laugh, you're triggering your brain, the pleasure centers in your brain, and it makes you feel good. How are you viewing the world, and are you comparing yourself to other people, right? The way you talk about other people. I love how Brené said, I gave up gossip for Lent. Like, what else do you talk about? Did you hear what she did? She's having twins. We make stuff, I mean, not that we make it up, but we invent things. And when we're not stressed, we invent stuff to be stressed about, right? How you see the world shapes how you see yourself. If you're not happy with where you are, start examining the way you look at the world and the stories you tell yourself about it. Next. Humor. Humor. That's my grandma. I'm joking, it's not. Humor. So it turns out laughter triggers the same mechanism in your brain as sex and chocolate. In fact, British researchers found that laughter is the same brain activity as eating 2,000 chocolate bars. I want to do that experiment. I'll never sleep again, but I'll be happy, right? So 2 things. 1, humor, right? And if you can't laugh at yourself, you got to, Right? We've all left the bathroom with toilet paper hanging out of our skirt. We have all had an entire meeting with spinach in our teeth when nobody told us. And ladies, you need to tell people when they have spinach in their teeth. We've all gone to the restroom while wearing a live lavalier. Or maybe that's just me. Oh, yeah, done that. Been there. Not fun. But I got a crazy applause when I walked back in the room. Apparently, the way I go gets a standing ovation. Our social connection is more a determinant of our longevity, how long we will live, than high blood pressure, diabetes, and smoking. And obesity. Our social connection. I hear a lot of people go, I don't have time. I want to schedule time to go have coffee with my friends. I make it a goal. I literally have a goal where I have one meal or one cup of coffee or one social interaction with a friend each week. And there are weeks where I don't hit that goal. And that's okay because we're human. But if I'm not deliberate about it, 6 months goes by and I'm like, oh, yeah, I miss you. And we see each other on Facebook, but it's not the same. It doesn't substitute for that. That human connection is so incredibly important. Now, this is one I would tell you a year ago, I would have told you, this is so ridiculous. I am not going to find my full lotus. I'm not going to eat tofu. I'm not going to think about Zen. I thought it was the dumbest thing in the world. I am as type A can get. I am constantly thinking. My husband says I have a million browser tabs open all the time. I could go from, I forgot to send the email, we need bananas! Like, it just, woo! But it turns out that there's a difference, okay? So first, there's mindfulness. Now, mindfulness is nothing more than paying attention on purpose. Evan was getting his hair cut, and it used to take 3 or 4 people to hold him down. And I looked over, and I was watching him get his hair cut, and he was just talking and laughing with the hairdresser. And I almost missed it because I was on my phone checking to see how many Instagram likes I had. I almost missed it. I call those things delicious moments. And in my office, I have a gigantic, I had to get a bigger one. I had a cork board. And every time I have a really great moment, like I'll take a picture with you. It'll be so amazing. It'll be on my cork board. Every time I get a card that really inspires me or someone says, thank you, you made a difference. Or I get an email that tells me I changed someone's life. Those are all on my delicious moments boards. And I look at it every day. I stare right at it. Recently, I had to get double the size of the board because I filled it up. But it's a reminder that we have all these delicious moments if we just stop to savor them. Think about when you're a kid, right? We all get fairy tales read to us and we read them to our kids and they all end with the same sentence. And they lived. And then we lose a job or we get a divorce or we fail. And all of a sudden we're like, well, I guess I screwed that up. Guess I didn't do this life thing right. That's not how life works. Happy is not a constant state. It happens in these micro moments, in these blips, in delicious moments. And our overall outlook is our collection of those. Savor those moments rather than go check your phone. Take a deep breath. I walked in an elevator at the hotel yesterday and everyone was staring at their phone. I said, hey, y'all. People looked at me like I had two heads. Right? We're so busy being busy. Busy doesn't equal successful. It equals tired. Be effective, not busy. Now, meditation is something different. Meditation is focus on the breath. And I thought I was failing miserably because I would sit there and I'd focus on my breath. All right. Oh, I forgot to email Barbara. Okay, forget it. Breathe. What are we going to have for dinner? Breathe. It was like playing whack-a-mole with my thoughts. Why does my leg itch? Do I have a rash? I mean, it was just one thing after another, right? Until I started researching this. And what I learned is that you can't screw it up. Meditation does not mean you find your zen while you are sitting there breathing. It means your mind races and you bring it back to your breath. And every time you do, you're training your attention. See, when our brain is stressed, we reduce the gray matter. And that's the part of our brain that's responsible for emotional regulation and attention. Okay? Every time you bring yourself back to your breath, it might be, I meditate for 10 minutes a day, and I might spend 8 of them not realizing that my mind has wandered. But every time you bring it back to your breath, you're increasing that resilience muscle because you're basically saying, I am controlling my brain rather than it control me. And then when you lay there at night ruminating about whatever it was that happened that day, you train your brain to go back to your breath. I fall asleep every night by meditating, every single night. And I'm usually out in 10 minutes. And if I wake up in the middle of the night with a, I forgot to email so-and-so, I breathe myself back to sleep. The average deeply relaxed person breathes 7 times a minute. I was working with a client and they had a new like undergraduate class that had just started and it was a high potential program. And I asked them, count your breath. I did it this morning with a group. Here's 1 minute, count your breath. How many times did you breathe? Now the average deeply relaxed person breathes 7 times a minute, 7. I had a young woman before I said that was the correct answer. She goes, 23. And the kid next to her was like, ha, 25. 7. And did you know that 3 deep breaths, like diaphragm, like pooch your belly out, ladies, resets your entire nervous system? 3 deep breaths. I have people ask, do you get nervous when you get on stage? You've done this for so long. Hell yes, I get nervous. I stood behind that and took 3 deep breaths right before I walked on. And if you can't just take deep breaths in the hallway, go to the bathroom and do it. It's not the ideal place to take deep breaths, but you do what you have to do, right? We forget to breathe. When we breathe, most of us, if you were to hold your hand to your chest, your sternum, and your stomach, and just pay attention to how you breathe, most of us breathe from our chest. They're shallow breaths. Our brain's not getting enough blood or oxygen to work effectively. We're supposed to breathe from our diaphragm. Next time you feel yourself multitasking and getting frantic and frenetic, catch yourself. How are you breathing? And take a really deep breath. I downloaded an app because I had no idea how to meditate. There's Calm, there's Buddhify, there's Headspace, there's a million different apps out there. They have breathe bubbles, where it tells you the bubble expands when you breathe in and it holds and it, you know. And these sound so silly. I have people say, are these really supposed to help build resilience? Yes. For different people, different ones work. Meditation might not work for you, and that's okay. It doesn't mean you're bad or you failed. But give it a shot, like a legitimate shot, like 3 months, 10 minutes a day. You can do it for 5 and still get a lot of the same benefit. 9 minutes is the magical number that changes your brain. Service to others. That's Senator Kirk Watson here in Austin. I hope that I'll get a chance to meet you at the book table afterwards. If you don't want to buy a book, that's fine, but I love hugs. And I'm the kind of person that snuggles. So I'm going to get in there in your neck and just kind of hold on. Because hugs create dopamine. And they actually did a study. Huggers live longer. And they have better relationships. So if you're one of those people who does that uncomfortable pat on the back, get over it and snuggle. I mean, just warm right up in there, right? It turns out doing a good deed is the single biggest momentary increase in dopamine that you can possibly achieve. And it does more for you than the person you're helping. It's actually called a helper's high. It does more for you. I was speaking at a conference much like this, and there was a Starbucks. And I was late for my speech. I was running late and there's a woman in front of me at the Starbucks who clearly has never had Starbucks. And she's like, what's a tall? What's a grande? How do I know if I want a whip? And I was like, ma'am, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to be rude or insensitive, but I'm in a hurry. I just need a cup of black coffee and I am happy to buy your coffee for you. So all of a sudden she's an expert. I want a venti pumpkin spice latte, a blueberry scone and 2 bottles of water, right? So I pay for it, and she starts crying. And I turned to her, and I said, I'm so sorry. I was just in a hurry, and I didn't mean to be insensitive. I'm really sorry. And she goes, that's not why I'm crying. I said, well, please tell me. And she said, I'm crying because today's my birthday, and you're the only person who will get me a present. A random act of kindness doesn't have to cost anything. I sat at lunch today and poured water in somebody else's glass, and they were like, thank you so much. They didn't pay me to do that. But when it came time for me to get a cup of coffee, guess what they did? They poured my coffee, right? Reciprocity. People want to do for you when you do for them. Do it with no expectation of anything in return. Yes, you hope people reciprocate. But I hear people say, well, I've changed my behavior. Why don't they change theirs? Because you can't control them. Don't waste your energy being miserable and get consumed with negative energy, stop yourself and breathe. Like, I literally view a stop sign in my head when I start going down that path. And sometimes the force is too strong and I go to the dark side, right? And I start getting pissed about stupid stuff. But more often than not, I can redirect. Gratitude. I think Sean Aker said this. Simply looking for something to be grateful for. Just looking. You don't even have to find anything. Just looking drops cortisol by 23%, the stress hormone. Just looking. And anytime you find something, you get what's called a dopamine squirt. And it sounds dirty, but it's not. A dopamine squirt is a rush in your brain of the feel-good neurochemical. You get serotonin as well. These are the chemicals and antidepressants. And because you find what you look for when you start looking for things to be grateful for, those delicious moments, you attune your brain to pay attention to those things. Now, it doesn't happen naturally for me. I don't wake up and go, oh, the sun is shining. I don't have unicorns farting cupcakes in my bedroom. You know, doves are not released when I walk into a room. I have bad days. But it's a moment-by-moment choice, right? On my wall, I have, what do you want to see today? Go look for it. Because if you want to see why all the people piss you off, you will find it. If you want to see all the reasons life isn't fair and you should have gotten this and they got this instead, you'll find it. Look for the little moments and savor those. Be grateful that you're here, that you have people around you that you love in your life, that it's about to be Thanksgiving, right? Be thankful every day, not just Thanksgiving Day. All right, so if you want that self-care sheet, I want you to text 555-888, and the code is TCFW, and you will get your Tuesday Truth Bomb once a month, and you will get a self-care sheet, and you will get a resilient self-assessment. All right, so last thing I'm going to ask you to do before I take questions, I want you to raise your arm up in the air. I want you to point your index finger at the ceiling, and I want you to pretend like that clock is directly above your head. Okay. Now, I want you to trace the second hand of that clock going faster than a second hand would go to the right, clockwise. Okay? You guys look stupid. All right. Clockwise. All right. Now, while you're doing that, lower your arm down just below your chest. Now, what direction is your clock going? I'm a wizard. Woo! There's always people in the back. I don't get it. And you're going to see people on the break walking downstairs. There's still someone trying to figure it out. Your direction did not change. What did? Your perspective. What does a snail say while riding on the back of a turtle? Whee! Perspective, right? Put it in perspective. Even on our worst day, even when we are the most sad and the most hurt, there are still different ways to look at the situation. Recently, I had to make an excruciating decision, and I haven't shared this with a group yet, but my husband and I had to put my son in a residential treatment center. It was an excruciating decision. It was horrible. But every day, I thank God that he's with safe people. He's with people who can protect him, and that we have a safe home, and that I can sleep through the night, and I don't have to lock my door. Right? And I felt guilty for feeling that way. That's your brain playing tricks on you. Enjoy your successes, right? Enjoy the moments and feel grateful for them. Is it hard? Yes, it's hard. Anybody in here who has children knows no matter how well behaved they are, it's hard. But it's about what you choose to look at, because when you start being critical, you find all the reasons you should be. And then it creates this domino effect. You criticize your spouse, they nag you. And it goes back and forth until one of you stops. And it's not like the second you stop, the other person is just going to be done because you've trained them. It takes time to untrain. So I know that Austin traffic is bad, and I know everybody at the Q&A part wants to run out. But I'm going to ask you just to hold on for just a couple minutes so we can hear questions. And I want to take questions from the group. Somebody ask a question, though, because... Yes, ma'am. There's a microphone right there.
Could you speak a little bit about the comparative suffering? Because I've been through some adversity, and when I tell people, they say, oh, well, it's nothing like what you've gone through. And I think it really kind of stops our dialogue. And I say, well, what you've gone through is just different. It's not a race. You know?
And I'm still guilty of it. My husband will say, I had a really bad night's sleep. And I'm like, well, it was nothing compared to my bad night's sleep. Right? I'm still guilty of doing it. Comparative suffering means whatever you are going through is real to you. You don't have to justify it. You don't have to defend it. All you have to do is give yourself permission to be with it. Most of us run from really uncomfortable emotions, but that's where resilience is built. You'll either succeed or survive. One or the other. You're living proof. You're sitting here, right? Everybody struggles at 100%. Now, some people have a permanent seat on the struggle bus, right? But we all struggle at 100%. You can't make people change the way they talk to you, but you can change the way you talk to yourself. Other questions? Yes.
I have a question. How do you encourage resilience in other people? Because sometimes you don't want to sound like this annoying person, like, just be resilient, just be happy, just do this. How do you do it, like, with sensitivity and care, but also being very honest and forward?
Well, you can't make somebody else be resilient. You can model the behavior and hope they follow. And I'm hoping they start teaching this stuff in school because I use resilience way more than math. Okay? You can't make somebody, you can model it. Leaders who model resilience, who turn their email off when they leave at work, when they leave the day and they turn their email off, they're modeling resilience and self-care and boundaries. When they take a vacation and they trust that everything's going to be okay and they don't call in every day, they're modeling resilience. That's all you can do. You can give people the research. You can tell them all the time, but we make decisions emotionally until it hurts bad enough. You know, I'll end with this, okay? Unless somebody has a question. Yes, ma'am. I wish I had some brilliant advice for that. I have two teenagers. I'm sorry? Turn off your router. Now, to me, it's like you get X amount of time. You can use that time however you want on it, but that's how much time we allocate a day. And if you have an amazing day, I'll give you a little bit more time, right? But it's not a given. It's not a right. Okay. All right, so you have two old men on a porch swing, Earl and Bubba, and Earl and Bubba have a giant hound dog sitting between them. And every once in a while, this hound dog wails. And Earl turns to Bubba and he says, Bubba, what's wrong with your dog? And Bubba says, well, Earl, he's sitting on a nail. Earl says, Bubba, why don't he move? Bubba says, well, Earl, I guess it don't hurt bad enough. The truth is, you have to be willing to get up off the nail and be uncomfortable, like the lobster, finding your inner lobster, to get where you want to be, or settle for where you are and stop bitching about it. It's the only thing. Whatever you do, know that you, just as you are right now, you are enough. You are smart enough. You are brave and courageous enough. You are resilient enough. And you are strong enough. Thank you.